it's not just that I mourn the tree that is cut down in front of my house. I mourn the public process or lack of public process and imagination that could have saved that tree had we been open to a different way of doing road work, a different way of understanding the tree as a part of an ecosystem, a different way of saying that tree shaded my house so I didn't need air conditioning, you know, a holistic way of thinking about something that is living and then is lost.
Welcome to the Spiritual Care Partners podcast, where each month we will dive deep into questions of trauma, grief, and healing with practical applications and new insights for trauma-informed, spiritually integrated care. You can access our podcast, lectures, community discussions, and a global community of care providers at www.spiritualcarepartners.com. I'm your host, Charlotte McAdams, and today I'm joined by the Reverend Allison Cornish, an inspiring guest and interfaith leader in caring for ecological grief. Speaking with Allison pushed me to think about who I want to be in a climate-changed world. She surprised me in her ability to acknowledge both the dire state of the climate, with increasingly deadly temperatures and natural disasters, and hold a grounded hope that humanity will continue and the everyday miracles of existing in this world will continue to unfold. Welcome to the show, Allison. Could you give us a brief overview of who you are and what you do?
I'm Allison Cornish, and I am coming to you from the BTS Center, which is actually located in Portland, Maine, where I serve as the chaplaincy initiative coordinator.
Wonderful to have you here. You spent the first half of your professional career working as a historic preservationist and architectural historian before attending Andover Newton Theological Seminary. What led to this shift in your career, and how did you see a religious education as a part of your calling to environmentalism?
What a rich question, Charlotte. Thank you for that. And it casts me back a few years to recount a little bit of that journey. I am one of those sort of odd Unitarian Universalists that never left my traditions. So I started out as a Unitarian Universalist as a kid through high school and liberal religious youth and all through college, and just continued in the religion and continued then to become a lay leader in my congregation. So that part of life was always there. And architectural history, historic preservation, I loved uncovering the mystery of buildings and having them tell their stories to us in a different kind of way. And I guess in some ways, I felt like I was sort of an advocate for the past, for the unspoken, for, what could be so easily lost to us. And I do believe that what we have from the past does inform our present and our future. And I just loved that work a lot. But I'll tell you that one day I was on the telephone with somebody going, and it was somebody that I talked with quite often, and I knew that he just was not himself that day. And I risked asking him what was going on in his life, and he told me that his grandmother had died, as he was to her. And he started talking about her life and what it meant to him, and I just had that moment. I guess it was sort of a road to Damascus moment of like, wow, I bet you there are a lot of people in the world that can figure out how to fix a roof or how to get the right windows into a building. But I'm not sure how many people are called to sit and listen to somebody else's pain and story and be present to it. And it's not the first time that I have thought about going to seminary, but it was the time that stuck. And in fact, the latter part of your question there, when I go back and look at my essay that I wrote in order to get into Andover Newton, my major purpose for going to seminary was, what is it that we are doing to our planet that is killing it? I wanted to know more about that question and to really investigate it. And I wanted to do it with people who thought deeply about the meaning of life and not just the meaning of life, but what our actions are that emerge from that deep search.
Before we move on, could you just introduce us to the BTS Center itself and explain what you do and what it's trying to prepare people for?
Absolutely. The BTS Center is both new and very old. So BTS actually stands for the Bangor Theological Seminary, and we are the legacy organization of Bangor Theological Seminary. So that's one of the oldest Protestant seminaries in this country. So we are no longer a degree-granting institution, but we are continuing education for people who are recognizing that they're doing their work in a climate change world. And particularly, we're focused on religious leaders, spiritual leaders, people who are in congregations, spiritual directors, chaplains, folks who have been understanding for a while, and now, of course, the conditions are pressing down on us a little bit harder. But then there are new questions of meaning. There are new ways of doing work in the world that we're called to do because we're in a climate change environment. So the work that I do in particular is with chaplains and chaplains of, in all different settings and in all different sectors. We call it the Climate Conscious Chaplaincy Initiative. So we're recognizing that if somebody's serving in a university, they're serving in palliative care or a hospice, if they are in a hospital, perhaps they're in a prison, maybe they're a community chaplain working with various activists and movements, all doing that work in a world where people are feeling more anxiety, more anger, more frustration, more fear, and in different circumstances too. I mean, just as an example, a hospital chaplain may really have trained to be present to people who are hospitalized for very understandable reasons, illnesses and diseases and accidents and trauma, etc. And they have incredible skills for that. But what happens when a wave of people come in from a wildfire? And there's compound trauma and issues there. Not only may they have experienced smoke inhalation or a loss of a family member, but also their home is gone. They may or may not be able to rebuild. They may or may not even be able to go back to where their home was. So there's this other understanding of loss that has to come into the chaplain's work.
I'd like to create a little bit of context around what a climate-changed world is. So, you know, for people who maybe only see the headlines or aren't as immersed in this world, what key areas do you think that people need to be educated in regarding climate change and ecological grief itself? And why does this matter right now?
Yeah, it's such a good question, Charlotte. I think, you know, first of all, the science behind human-caused changes to our climate is sound. Just have to say that kind of out loud. It's because we are carrying on our lives as if this is not a crisis, and it is. But it's a crisis right now with a lot of veils over it. So I would say the first thing is to accept the science. It is real. It is human caused. Changes are becoming much more present for people in this part of the world. You look at people in Bangladesh, or you look at people in Indonesia, or people in the Himalayas, they've experienced these effects much more dramatically for quite a long time now. These precipitation events that people are experiencing in Maryland or Portland, Oregon, or in Houston, Texas, or in Vermont last summer. These are new and they're going to continue. And people will experience a lot of loss. Right now, I think we're more in the shock and surprise level, and still our brains are trying to say that's the 1 in 100 year storm or 1 in 500 year storm. But they're not. They're going to become much more regular in terms of their events, as are the rising heat indexes that affect all kinds of people, but particularly people who are living outside, or unhoused, children with asthma, elderly that may or may not have respiratory problems. A wider and wider swath of the population is going to be affected by these changing conditions that we experience as weather, but are caused by the climate that has changed. So just to be sort of specific for a moment, I live in Western Massachusetts. It's an area of a lot of small farms, 10 acres and under. These are farmers that are relying primarily on community-supported agriculture, CSAs, and farmers markets, and maybe a little bit of wholesale in order to make it. 2 years ago, we had a drought. Small farmers haven't invested in irrigation. They never needed irrigation before. Last year, we had the floods. One of the small farms that's been in business for over 20 years as a CSA lost everything. They lost all of their crops. Never had the South River flooded in that way and taken out so much area. And on top of it, it was a certified organic farm. Certification gets lost when you're flooded with floodwaters. So incredible financial costs and incredible mental health costs for these farmers. Now, just this past weekend in the newspaper, there's an article about mental health services for farmers in Massachusetts because of the incredible anxiety and depression and worry and making it on small margins that these farmers are going through. But this is our food source. I mean, here in Western Massachusetts, many of us, that's how we eat in 2 to 3 seasons is from these small farms. This is why we live here. This is what we want to support. This is how people are making their living. This is how they're caring for the land. All the right things. And yet the climate is making it almost impossible to have any kind of security.
I was just thinking, as you were speaking, chaplaincy has such a rich element of storytelling and holding people's stories. And I see that thread through a lot of the work you've been doing, is this interest in finding stories, keeping stories. Do you remember the first moment where you started caring about the earth, or a moment in your childhood where you felt this connection with the earth that has kind of sparked this lifelong passion for environmentalism?
Absolutely. I was outdoors a lot as a child, sometimes in the backyard, sort of in the trees and in the leaves and building little structures and just immersing myself in the outdoors. I remember very vividly going to Elizabeth Park in Hartford with my parents, and I was really young, and there's a pond there, and something was moving in the bottom of the pond, and I wanted to see what it was. I just wanted, and so of course I was in the pond rather than looking into the pond very quickly, and roundly reprimanded for getting my shoes and my socks all wet and muddy. But I was just compelled to see more deeply. So I've always been drawn to the water. I've been so fortunate to live near bodies of water pretty much since I was in my early 20s. It's so, so important to me. And I think that my father really instilled in me a cosmology that had to do with the natural world. He was a big fan of the Thornton Burgess books that were written right here in Massachusetts. And those are all about how the animals and the meadow and the pond and the brook and even the wind all come together to create this place, this ecosystem that we live in. And humans are usually absent from those stories. And yes, they anthropomorphize animals and all things that we know better now. But I think it just instilled in me very early that there's a world that's pulsing with life, separate from what we do and how we do it. And being present to that, observing that, being curious about it, that's our human world.
I love the word presence. I hear a lot about the ministry of presence, and and I think we think of that in terms of being with humans, but I'm also hearing that you can be present with the earth, and the earth also has such a presence that we're maybe not even picking up on, and this ministry is alive all around us already.
Oh, we're in such our infancy of learning about how the forest is present to us and to our activities, and how the forest communicates with itself, but also that it takes time to absorb our presence and begin to respond to us. Sister Miriam McGillis, a Dominican sister who's been really influential for me, used to talk about walking through the woods and reminding us that we are being watched. We are being seen by the forest as much as we are seeing the forest.
I'm so glad you brought up Sister Miriam McGillis, because I was so curious about your studies with other faith leaders. So you're ordained in the UU tradition, but you've also done so much interfaith work, including studying with the Buddhist teacher, Joanna Macy. So first of all, what draws you to interfaith work, and what has it taught you about tending to the earth and also to the grief, the ecological grief that we have?
That's such a rich question. I mean, just going back and saying, yes, I mean, being a lifelong Unitarian Universalist, I have moved theologically quite a bit. Interfaith work, it comes, I think, maybe naturally to me as a Unitarian Universalist. Our sources talk about the world's religious traditions as being important influences for us. And when I stepped into a setting like chaplaincy in a hospital or a setting even like seminary where there are people from so many different traditions, I loved it. I mean, I just loved hearing other people's expressions and stories and ideas. It never felt threatening to me. It never felt threatening to my own theology. It made me understand my own commitments more deeply. And as I understood those more deeply, I was even more open to learning from others. Joanna Macy has been hugely influential for me. And to turn to your question about grief, Joanna, in her work that reconnects that she developed with Molly Brown, talks about the spiral and the spiral that we continue to experience sometimes in the course of a day, sometimes over the course of a lifetime, but we always start in gratitude. Every faith tradition starts in gratitude and expressing our gratitude for life itself. And then her spiral works around to honoring our pain for the world, because the more gratitude we have, the more love that's generated in us, the greater our awareness of what we're losing. I mean, Mary Oliver talks about, you know, our task in life is to love it deeply and hold it tight and then let it go. And we are doing a lot of letting go right now, which is really, really hard work. Joanna goes on and says, you can't stop at the pain. You have to honor it. You have to recognize it and feel it fully. But then you need to move around and realize what bonding that experience is with others and see the world with new eyes, see it with fresh eyes. That's very much grounded in the Buddhist understanding of, you know, suffering as part of life. And but we don't stop there. We recognize it. We hold it with one another. And then we find our way forward to life.
I'm so glad that you made it a local problem. No matter where you live, it's happening now to people who are our neighbors. Can you just kind of, in your own words, define what ecological grief is?
Yeah. So I think a word that's really helpful here is a portmanteau word that was developed by Glenn Albrecht, who's a philosopher in Australia. And he talks about solastalgia. And solastalgia to him is a word that means we no longer receive the comfort we once had when we think of a place as home. And this word came out of a very specific experience for him. He was talking with a group of people in the Black Hills of Australia who were watching their forests be cut down because of the coal mining that was going on in the area. And these people used to walk in these forests and cherish these forests and understand deeply the biodiversity that these forests supported. And there's a part of solastalgia that I think is really important, because the damage, the harm, the loss is happening by forces that are beyond our control. And I think that that's a part of the ecological grief that we need to put into the mix. It's not just that I mourn the tree that is cut down in front of my house. I mourn the public process or lack of public process and imagination that could have saved that tree had we been open to a different way of doing road work, a different way of understanding the tree as a part of an ecosystem, a different way of saying that tree shaded my house so I didn't need air conditioning, you know, a holistic way of thinking about something that is living and then is lost. So it's complicated because it means that we have to fess up to our complicity. We have to recognize that we live in systems that we did not design, that we've inherited from the Industrial Revolution, from rampant capitalism, from consumer and materialism, which is all the reasons that over and over again, the BTS Center maintains that the climate crisis is a spiritual crisis. It's a crisis of values. It's a crisis of defining what is the good life. It's a crisis of right relationship. And it's a crisis of understanding ourselves as kin in the natural world. And when I recognize all of those parts of the crisis, I am in deep, deep sorrow and deep mourning.
So beautiful, so beautifully put. And I'm glad you brought up the spiritual component. And I'd love to dig a little bit deeper into that. I think of climate change as something that I see scientists dealing with, mm-hmm. I see politicians dealing with, but what is the role of a spiritual care practitioner in addressing climate change and addressing ecological grief?
Wow, that is definitely, you've just named the mission of the BTS Center in a nutshell there. Absolutely, technology has a role in this. And, you know, we need to find the will to deploy more and more of the technological solutions that are already available to us, recognizing that all of them come with some amount of baggage. I mean, there's no completely clean energy. So I think of the spiritual work as multivarious. Part of that spiritual work is holding the grief and recognizing it and tending to it and normalizing it and lamenting together, because the last thing we need right now is to feel alone and isolated with our own understandings of what's going on the planet. We need company, and we need to be held by others and hold one another. So that's really important work. Hope is also, you know, the purview very often of people who call themselves spiritual leaders, and not a false hope. not that everything's going to be all right. Not that there is a super deity somehow that's going to swoop in and take care of this in a way that I think is a fantasy, unfortunately. but a real grounded hope, a hope that's grounded in the reality of what we have, and yet believes that our species has done amazing things. We are incredibly resilient. We are incredibly intelligent. We can be incredibly compassionate. We can be incredibly transformative for ourselves and one another. And I think that's where the chaplaincy comes in here. The chaplaincy is really about how do we accompany people through what they're experiencing as they understand more and more of their lives in a climate change world.
Can you tell us about the concept of Earth Hospice and how it came about and what it is?
Yeah, thank you. I have been working on this with my friend and dear colleague, Trevi Johnson, who is the founder of an organization called Radical Joy for Hard Times. And Earth Hospice Rites really emerged from her own experience of accompanying her husband through hospice care and his death. And what came to Trevi, and what I really understand, is of course the Earth is not dying. The Earth is going to continue in some form. We don't know right now what form that will be, but the Earth as a planet will continue. But something very important is dying, and is dying every day. It's our understanding or our relationship to a particular place or a particular time that was very important to us and was related to our planet. So we developed this 20-minute every other week gathering where we welcome people in. It's online. We welcome people in. We invite people to pause whatever came before and to stop preparing for what is going to come next. And we offer reflection, usually based on something that's going on in the world right now. And we have people coming really regularly who say this is their spiritual community. This is a place that they know that they can come. And people don't question why they are sad. Don't question why they are angry. That's a given. That's up front. And they're going to have a moment of community, of communion, and an opportunity to think about things perhaps in a different way. We had a really challenging one a couple of weeks ago where we were talking about a heat wave. And we offered a scenario, a very specific scenario. You know, you're at a farmer's market and the heat is really unbearable. And you see, you know, an argument break out between a vendor and a customer. And you see a small child, you know, crying and moving towards a tantrum. And you see an elderly person just sort of sink to the ground, probably dehydrated, you know. In what way can you be of help? In what way do you respond in that? And putting people in an imaginative state like that, I think is really important because we need to rehearse this. We really need to rehearse how we want to be. Are we the person that goes for help, or are we the person that helps? Are we the person who's just sinks down and puts our arm around somebody until help arrives? Are we drawn to the young person? Are we drawn to the elderly person? I mean, we have to, I think, begin to see who we want to be in this climate change.
That sounds so challenging and meaningful and important. And I'm thinking about how ecological grief is not just grief, but it's often rage. And you mentioned earlier that we have this challenge of many young people are feeling like they're being left with this world that they didn't cause, with these changes that they didn't cause. And they're feeling so much anger. Can you walk us through how we might navigate intergenerational issues like blame and rage in this context?
That's such a good and such a challenging question, Charlotte. I think, and this is the first thing, and it sounds simple, and it is not, is to receive without defense, without defensiveness, and just to listen and say, you're right. I hear you. I'm taking in what you're saying. I'm not going to give you an excuse. I'm not going to give you an explanation. I'm just going to receive what it is. And let this spill out, because I think a lot of young people, first of all, don't have places and spaces that they can do that. Second of all, have been told that it's not acceptable. And more than anything, can have some real self-doubt about it. I mean, I think Greta Thunberg is a really good example of somebody who shows up with a certain amount of well-stated anger in almost every setting. There was a beautiful, beautiful conversation between her and David Attenborough in the film about her, where she did not show up with rage. She showed up with listening. Because this is the other side of the coin. Elders are sad. They're feeling shame and guilt and sorrow and remorse. And there has to be a place for that too. I think the worst thing that we can do for young people is to turn to them and say, now we're counting on you to fix this. Right.
Climate change is one of those issues where it's not a battle that you just get to win. There isn't going to be one piece of legislation that just fixes it all. So much of the challenge is how many emotions there are when you're thinking about it. There's this feeling of hopelessness, and there's this feeling of things are carrying on, and there can be hope too in that, and there's pain and there's grief. How do we balance all of those emotions?
Well, by doing what you just did, Charlotte, they're all legitimate. No one can take any of those feelings away from you. You're naming a reality there. And we've stopped thinking about climate at the BTS Center as a problem that can be solved. It's not. It's a predicament that we're living into. And that predicament calls us to choose how we want to be as people in this time and in this place. And when we think of it that way, Charlotte, I think we're much more aligned with all of our spiritual ancestors who have had to do the same thing, and wherever they were and whatever was going on. I mean, I think of my own ancestors, some of whom came through the Holocaust and some of them did not. All of them would have wanted to live in a different time and in a different place, but they didn't. and they couldn't. And they had to choose who they were going to be in that moment. And they did their best. I think that we have to begin to realize that we're in a time of great loss. And some of that loss is going to be experienced very personally. And it's going to be very hard. And that's one of the reasons that I think at the BTS Center, we give so much space to ecological grief. It is one of the griefs that we are experiencing right now. It's not the only one. People come to our lament for Earth with all kinds of sadnesses and losses on their heart. I think that the Earth can receive it. And I think actually the Earth can respond to hearing us lament. And I think the Earth appreciates being noticed in that way.
Thank you so much for that beautiful answer. What would you like to leave us with? What do you want us to know in this space, to hold in this space?
Well, I think the first thing is, even if you are out walking, listening to this podcast by yourself, please know that you're not alone. That the thoughts that are going through you, the feelings that are coursing through you because of the way in which our times are unfolding, are shared by many, many, many people. I think the other thing is, if you're really experiencing despair and hopelessness, find good help. And what good help means and looks like for you is not necessarily the same thing it's going to be for me. But don't allow the conditions of our world to pull you into a place of paralysis and in a place where you can no longer cherish what a gift life is. We all touch into that place, but if we're spending too much time in that place or can't get out of it, we need real help. And this is an invitation to find that help, whether it's a chaplain or a therapist or a faith community or your very best friend. Tell somebody that you need and get good help. I think the last thing I would say is, remember that miracles happen. And I don't mean miracles as in a flash of bolt of lightning or a genie coming out of a pot, but I mean a miracle that is an everyday miracle, that we wake up to something that we've been asleep to, or we recognize something in someone that we just didn't imagine could be part of who they were. Welcome the miracles in life and take them in and have them as a well that we can draw upon. I think that we have invested so much in the miracles of technology, we have completely forgotten that the miracle that we need may be in that tree or in that neighbor or in that gesture. And that's the kind of miracle that we need right now.
Thank you so much for tuning into this month's podcast on ecological grief with the Reverend Allison Cornish. To learn more, please visit us at www.spiritualcarepartners.com, and we look forward to you tuning in again next time.